The History Show with Maz Duncan.
Good evening. On this week's program, Dracula, Frankenstein, and the Defiance of Death.
They have in common this question about, are there ways in which human beings can either expand their life or eliminate death entirely?
We'll hear about the creation of two of literature's most iconic monsters, and Stoker and Shelley's connections to Ballyshannon, County Donegal. Also, the convening of the Boundary Commission in 1924.
So it was based on this wording, though the devil was in the details of Article 12. They put a lot of work into preparing for the Boundary Commission, but they don't know what they're preparing for because there's no definitive interpretation of the article.
Cormac Moore on a story of political manoeuvring, dashed nationalist hopes, and the determination of the Northern Ireland border. And to begin this evening, the Irish in multicultural Britain. Between the end of the Second World War and the early 21st century, Britain became multicultural, a process that offers lessons for modern Ireland, which has recently experienced its own transition towards a more diverse society. Irish immigrants were one of many groups who flocked to Britain during the 1950s and throughout later decades. Like other immigrant groups, they faced persistent hostility and discrimination, but over time created communities that changed the face of Britain, especially in its cities. A new book explores the history of multiculturalism in Britain, seeking to explain the contradictions in how that country reacted to immigration. It reveals a story of progress and cultural interchange, but also one in which politicians took advantage of anxieties over migrants and race for their own ends. That book, Multicultural Britain, A People's History, is written by historian Dr. Kieran Connell, who joins us to discuss this timely and often controversial topic. Kieran, you're very welcome.
Thanks for having me. Show.
Now, you have personal experience of multicultural Britain through your family history and your upbringing. Tell us about that background and how it might have influenced your decision to write this book.
Sure. So my parents met and grew up together in the city of Birmingham. They'd sent me to school in a part of Birmingham, which at that school I went to, there was maybe three or four white children. Everybody else were from either South Asian backgrounds. They were from Caribbean, South Asia, West Africa, East Africa, etc. And so growing up in that environment as a white child, you have I guess I had a very different understanding of multicultural Britain to the one which you generally see in the pages of newspapers or in terms of the speeches that are made by politicians. It was sort of, there was an everyday familiarity with ethnic diversity. So my first kiss was with a girl from a Yemeni background. My best friend, his parents were from Pakistan. And in that context, the things that become a focus of anxiety by politicians or in the media, things like celebrating, for example, different religious festivals or wearing different religious symbols to school, they're not a source of anxiety, they're just an everyday reality. And so that, alongside the fact that I have immigration within my own family history, so my great-grandparents came from County Cork, my grandmother came from Germany, there was a kind of familiarity with the different cultures that both Irish and German heritage comes with in my family growing up, I was keen to paint a different side of the story to what we generally hear. And I think that side of the story is, yes, there were problems, racism still exists, as we know in Britain, but there was also a kind of everyday familiarity with diversity, which I don't think is spoken about often enough in a British context.
So basically, you faced something that is greatly feared by the far right, which is that you were a white minority. You were in a very, very tiny white minority.
Yeah, 100%. And, you know, if you think about somebody like Enoch Powell, who some of your listeners may be aware of, MP for Wolverhampton, then subsequently became an MP for South Down towards the end of his career. But he was most famous for his so-called Rivers of Blood speech, in which he painted this dystopian figure of a white minority under attack from this unwarranted so-called alien invasion. So that was his ultimate nightmare, was to have white children in a minority in an ethically diverse school. My experience was a completely different one. And I would say that experience has been the foundation of my academic interest as a historian. That experience with diversity, that familiarity with diversity. And the point I try to make in the book is that my own experience is actually becoming the norm for a huge number of people, the length and breadth of Britain, whether that's places like London or Birmingham, which are well known for their diversity, but also new geographies too. So places like Milton Keynes, for example, a city which was only established in the mid-1960s, that city is now more diverse right now than even Birmingham was as recently as the 1980s. So it's increasingly, I argue, becoming a feature, a part of the fabric of modern Britain, to have this ethnic diversity written into the fabric of everyday life.
And did you face, I suppose, what would be called reverse discrimination?
No, in short, no. You know, there's always going to be tensions in any kind of social situation. There's always going to be some kind of tensions. Obviously, any school playground is going to have some type of bullying between one group of people and another. But I never experienced anything that you might call reverse racism. I always experienced it as being a positive and enhancing thing. Yes, I was called, for example, the Punjabi for white person, Gora. I was called a Gora, but I never took it as anything more than a bit of playground banter. And indeed, a lot of my friends taught me how to swear in Punjabi or count to 10 in Punjabi. You know,
Which have you found more useful?
Both equally useful in their own way, maybe put it like that. But no, but I think the reality is, I think that's a good example, actually, because we actually had our own way of talking. I call it a multicultural slang, which mixed in, as I say, Punjabi swear words with maybe a bit of Jamaican patois, inner city Brummie. You know, it was all mixed together. And actually that, to take a step back, I think that's, as I say, part of what it means to be British today, which is never reflected in the words of politicians, is to have these hybridised different identities which people are now increasingly comfortable using side by side.
Now, in the book, you concentrate on, obviously, on Birmingham and the Irish experience there. Birmingham saw an influx of Irish immigrants during the 1950s. Tell us about those immigrants. Why were they in the city of Birmingham? What did they do there? How were they treated in the 1950s?
So like most immigrants from Britain's former colonies, whether that's Ireland or whether that's the Caribbean, whether that's South Asia, they often, in many cases, were recruited to work in the factories and foundries of Birmingham, whether that's working in car factories or whether that's building the M1 motorway, you know, to do manual jobs which were often unpopular with native English and British people. So, you know, they were often recruited because they were a cheap source of labour. And the Irish, I think, did experience discrimination in a similar way to the experiences of people who had, you know, black skins or brown skins. So, you know, one of the things I heard most from the people I talked to when I wrote this book was the signs that were placed in bed and breakfast: no blacks, no Irish, no dogs. Undoubtedly, that discrimination was a real feature of what Irish people experienced. And, you know, you see that in a whole variety of different ways. So you had a reluctance to rent rooms to Irish people in B&Bs. You had some pubs which refused to serve Irish customers. And that discrimination definitely got worse when the IRA's bombing campaign reached England. And so you had the Birmingham pub bombings in 1974, Manchester pub bombings, attacks in Brighton as well. And what happened in the aftermath of those bombings was that discrimination reached a whole new level for the Irish. So you had examples where certain British employees would refuse to work shifts with Irish employees. Certain shops would refuse to stock Irish goods. You had even some examples where there was a refusal to carry Irish passengers on airliners. So I think the Troubles had a really, really big impact. But the broader point, I think, is that there was still this hangover from the colonial era of stereotypes about the Irish, which associated them as being, you know, backward or drunkards or prone to fighting one another in the streets. And I think there were definitely similarities between the way in which the Irish were treated and the way in which black or South Asian migrants were treated, but for one really important distinction, which is that the Irish were white.
Yeah.
And if you're white, you can walk down the street and not immediately be visible as being Irish. Whereas if you're a black or South Asian, that's a very, very different situation.
You have to open your mouth before you're identified as such and not immediately.
Yeah.
I mean, one, I was astonished, I must say, by this figure. 1961, there were 644,000 Irish immigrants in England, and almost 10% of them living in Birmingham. You also highlight a major incident in Birmingham in 1968 in your own neck of the woods, Bolsall Heath, involving about 20 Irish traveller families who settled in the area. What happened there?
Yeah, so Bolsall Heath, that's the area that I went to school in the 1990s. But what happened in 1968 was that a traveller community had set up shop on a patch of disused land in this inner city area. Now, Bolsall Heath, just for your listeners, was a rundown area, very poor quality housing, outside toilets, no hot water, no central heating in some cases. And partly for that reason, it was home to large numbers of immigrants from all over the world, because this was where the cheapest housing was available. So I think what happened was this traveller community probably thought, well, it's a rundown area. Maybe this will be a place where we can kind of live for a short period and not face too much hassle. But in fact, the opposite was true. So what happened was there was a huge amount of anxiety and resentment towards this traveller community from, for example, from the parents, of local children who threatened to withdraw their children from school until that traveller site was moved on, from politicians who argued that this traveller site was the most filthy and disgusting that they'd ever come across. And in the end, what actually happened in towards the end of the summer of 1968 was that the city council brought in dozens of police officers to essentially force the travellers to move on. They dug what was described as a quote-unquote anti-tinker ditch around that site to stop the travellers being able to come back at any point in the future. So what I argue in the book is that there was a huge amount of anxiety focused on the immigrant communities of these inner city areas. They were seen as being a source for the kind of poor quality nature of the houses and the nature of the communities more generally in these areas. And I think there was a sense that if this one traveller community were removed, that might solve all these wider problems that were understood to blight the area. So it's a good example, I think, of the way in which, and this, interestingly enough, this traveller community also included some settled members of the Irish community as well, who were unable to find work for various reasons. But I think it's a good example of the way in which some Irish communities were the focus of this much broader anxiety, not just about the way in which the inner city had changed in the post-war years, but also I think the kind of the ghost that's hanging over this entire history is the fact that Britain in this period had moved from being a nation which had an empire that covered one third of the world's landmass in 1945 to, by the time we get into the late 60s and early 1970s, basically that empire had crumbled away. And I think that is the kind of, as I say, it's the ghost hanging over this entire story, that Britain's inability to process its transition from an imperial nation to a post-imperial nation.
Now, you've also already highlighted the problematic relationship between the Irish community in Birmingham and the people of Birmingham in the wake of the Birmingham bombings. To some extent, perhaps, can you view the attitude of people in Birmingham towards the Irish through the prism of the St. Patrick's Day Parade?
You know, so that's a good example. So the St. Patrick's Day Parade first emerged in Birmingham in the 1950s. Thousands of people would take part in it every year. You know, it's a part of a broader sense in which in the 50s and 60s, the Irish were sort of becoming settled in Birmingham in particular, but in Britain as a whole. So in various parts of Birmingham, you'd be able to buy Irish newspapers. In Irish pubs, the songs like The Wild Colonial Boy would be sung, sometimes to a button accordion, traditional Irish button accordion. So they were becoming settled as a kind of feature of everyday life in Birmingham and in Britain. But then with the pub bombings, that changed things drastically. And with the discrimination that I've already talked about that came in the aftermath of the pub bombings, I think what happened was that the Irish community turned in on themselves and sort of were reluctant to celebrate their Irishness because they knew that if they put their head above the parapet, that could lead them open to discrimination in various forms. And the St. Patrick's Day Parade didn't run for the next, I think, 22 years after the Birmingham pub bombings. And it's only in more recent times that Irish people or people from the Irish diaspora in Birmingham have felt confident enough, I think, to celebrate their Irishness. And right now, Birmingham's St. Patrick's Day Parade actually is one of the biggest in the world.
Now, I mean, you obviously, it's clear that Irish migrants did experience persistent discrimination in Britain. But as you note in the book, ultimately, it was non-white racial minorities who bore the brunt of community tensions, wasn't it?
100%. And I think this is where we have to be careful. So there were parallels to be drawn between the Irish and black and South Asian migrants. But the crucial distinction is race. And the fact that if you're black and you're Asian and you're living in a majority white society, you're immediately visible as such and you have to carry on your shoulders the burden of all the stereotypes associated with quote-unquote blackness. And I think the thing that shows that most clearly is in 1962, the British government introduced the first legislation designed to curb immigration in the 20th century, the Commonwealth Immigrants Act. And the aim, straightforwardly, was to restrict the ability of black and South Asian migrants to enter into Britain.
The Irish were exempt, weren't they?
This is the key point, though. Mm. So they sold it to the public. They couldn't come out and say, we want to stop all black and Asian immigrants. So they sold it to the public as being about stopping, quote-unquote, unskilled migrants. Vast majority of migrants from places like Jamaica, Pakistan and India would have been unskilled, that's true. But the Irish were exempt, and the vast majority of Irish migrants coming into Britain were
equally
also unskilled,
yeah.
Which demonstrated the kind of barefaced racism behind that piece of legislation, but also demonstrates the distinction between the experience of Irish migrants and the experience of black and Asian migrants in Britain.
And the non-white immigrants when did they start to come in numbers? I mean, are we talking about the 1960s? I mean, the Irish had been coming for more than a century at this, since the famine, basically. But obviously the 1950s was huge. Are we talking about the 1960s?
Small black presence in Britain in the 19th and early 20th century, but really the black and Asian migrants start coming in big numbers after the Second World War. So from 1945 onwards, and the really important thing to keep in mind is that they came at the behest, at the request of the British government, because Britain in the late 40s and 50s had a severe labour shortage. There were simply not enough workers, not just to keep the economy ticking over, but also to establish the welfare state, to establish things like the National Health Service. So I don't think it's an overstatement to say that the National Health Service, just to take one example, it simply wouldn't have been possible without migrant labour of one kind or another, but especially migrant labour from Britain's former colonies.
Mm. Now, to an Irish audience, Enoch Powell's 1968 Rivers of Blood speech seemed to come out of nowhere. Would that be how it would have been perceived in Britain, in Birmingham?
So I think Powell was an opportunist that spotted that was a market, unfortunately in my view, but there was a market for this brand of populism that would scapegoat migrants. It didn't come out of nowhere, no. There would have been anti-migrant sentiment expressed, to take one example, in 1958, a series of race riots broke out in London and Nottingham. They consisted of essentially white people targeting black passers-by, targeting their property, smashing their windows. In one case, it led to a death in 1959 of a black member of the public. And I think those events have actually eerie parallels with the unrest that took place both in Dublin last year and across the UK in the August just gone.
And in Belfast.
Exactly, in Belfast as well. So, you know, I think there's a very strange and eerie parallel between what happened there. But what was striking about that was the lesson that the British government learned was that there was not a problem with white racism. The problem was too many ethnic minority immigrants. And Powell spotted that there was clearly a demand among a certain constituent for a politician that would sort of vocalise some of these more extreme views. And it's worth keeping in mind that in 1958, the people were crying, "Let's lynch the blacks." So if you judge them by their own words, this was an out-and-out racist riot.
Yeah, I mean, you reject the term race riots. You think they should be called racist riots.
I think race riots is almost a bit of a euphemism. I mean, what was occurring on these streets was groups of white people attacking black people and saying they wanted to get the blacks. And I think we should take them at their own word in that sense.
Are there lessons here for Ireland, do you think, in the British experience?
I mean, obviously the immigration debate now has become a live one in Ireland in a big way. And I think it's really a fascinating period that we're living through in terms of Irish history, whereby we're moving from a period where the term diaspora in Ireland generally means the people who've left Ireland. And now what we're having in Ireland, whether it's Dublin or elsewhere, is we're having whole new generations of migrants who are starting to think about diaspora as something that exists in an Irish context. And I think the lesson of the British experience with multiculturalism is that over a period of 70 years, governments, whether it's the Labour Party or the Conservative Party, have essentially allowed the far right to set the terms of the debate in one way or another. And I'll give you one example of that. You may remember the recent policy of the previous Conservative government was to send asylum seekers to have their claims processed in Rwanda. That policy was first proposed by the neo-Nazi British National Party in the 1980s. And that's just one example of the way in which the UK debate has been dragged to the right by a succession of far-right demagogues. And Enoch Powell will just be one among many examples. So I think the lesson for the Irish in terms of how they deal with the question of Ireland now becoming a multicultural society is that you cannot seek to appease the far-right. If you do try and appease the far-right, all that you do is legitimise far-right ideas and racism. There needs to be a principled stance, I think, that not just values the work that immigrants are doing, but also celebrates the fact that Ireland is now becoming an ethnically diverse society, and in some ways has already become that.
It's a superb read that ranges far beyond the Irish experience, obviously, exploring other immigrant communities in Birmingham, Cardiff, Nottingham and Bradford. Dr. Kieran Connell, many thanks
for
joining us on the programme, on The History Show, to talk about Multicultural Britain, A People's History, published by Hearst & Company. And after the break, we'll be hearing about the history behind Dracula and Frankenstein and Bram Stoker and Mary Shelley's family connections to County Donegal. Stay with us.
Follow us on Twitter at RTE History Show.
Welcome back. Now, as Halloween approaches, we're looking at two of the most iconic figures in Gothic literature, Dracula and Frankenstein's monster. Did you know that the authors of these famous works, Bram Stoker and Mary Shelley, both have a familial connection to a town in County Donegal? Our reporter, Mark McManaman, has the story.
Frankenstein and Dracula created, you know, these modern archetypes, mythic figures who have broken free of the novels that first gave them birth, and kind of they now populate all areas of popular culture.
It's alive! It's alive! It's alive!
The books are a good 56 years apart. They're written almost in the same way. They are somewhat a type of morality tale or whatever, but they're also shock and horror.
The Gothic novels Dracula and Frankenstein, or to give it its proper title, the modern Prometheus, have a lot in common. However, a lesser-known fact is that both authors' maternal grandmothers are buried in the same church, St. Anne's Church of Ireland, in Ballyshannon, County Donegal. Bram Stoker's grandmother was Charlotte Thornley of Sligo. The Stoker family fled to Ballyshannon during the cholera epidemic of 1832. According to Professor Jarlath Killeen of Trinity College Dublin, that incident is one of many influences on Stoker's writing.
The family fled Sligo to go to Ballyshannon during the period of the epidemic in Sligo. But we have to remember that the 19th century saw a kind of a wave of epidemics, a kind of a wave of cholera pandemics, five of them overall. So there was a huge anxieties around the spread of disease, about deterioration and death from disease, about quarantine, about control of the spread of disease. So that's definitely feeding in, just wave after wave of cholera epidemic in the 19th century.
The cholera story is an interesting one because Charlotte wrote about the cholera and her parents' remembrance of it.
This is Brian Drummond, a local historian from Ballyshannon. According to Brian, death was a major influence on the young Stoker. Images of coffins, plague, and the undead were hugely prevalent during his visit to Ballyshannon.
She talks about the move from Sligo to Ballyshannon to Donegal town, and the epidemic, and also how it affected people, and the death, and how people were being buried, and buried quickly. There is folklore. She speaks about graves and corpses and the plague, but she also writes about the shortage of coffins, the pitch cloth wrapping bodies. But then there's this interesting thing, this kind of folklore, this kind of image of some people were not quite dead when placed in, so you have this undead. And while people talk about his inspiration, Bram Stoker's inspiration for Dracula, people think that he got it from the famine and that time, but this is about 10 years earlier or more. And it's more likely he's referring back to the stories of his mother and grandmother about the cholera plague.
Listen to them, children of the night. What music they make.
Similarly, Mary Shelley also has a maternal connection to Ballyshannon. Local historian Brian Drummond.
If we look at Mary Shelley, her grandmother was Elizabeth Dixon Ballyshannon. We know primarily about her from a guy called Hugh Allingham, who is William Allingham, the poet's half-brother. He published a book called Ballyshannon's History and Antiquities in 1879. And he refers to this to notable people in the area. And one of them is Elizabeth Dixon, who lived in the main street. We're talking about the 1780s, 1790s, whatever. And he says the family are engaged with the wine trade and are said to have resided on the main street.
Elizabeth Dixon's daughter, Mary Shelley's mother, was Mary Wollstonecraft, the pioneering feminist writer.
When Allingham is writing about Elizabeth Dixon, he talks about her daughter, who is destined to become celebrated by the brilliancy and versatility of her literary talents. And she was married to William Goodwin, and Goodwin was a philosopher, a novelist, and a historian in his own time, a man of his own note.
In 1797, William Goodwin and Mary Wollstonecraft had a daughter together, also named Mary. Her life was marked by death and tragedy from the very beginning, as Wollstonecraft suffered a serious postpartum infection after giving birth.
And she dies 11 days after the birth of Mary. And Mary Goodwin, when she's about 16 years old, she actually runs away and marries a guy called Shelley, the man himself, the poet. They were married in 1816. And she obviously goes on to write Frankenstein, or the modern Prometheus.
According to Jarlath, the common theme of death is clear in both novels, as well as the portrayal of the human spirit and its need to conquer death, something that was no doubt a huge factor on both the writing of Bram Stoker and Mary Shelley.
They have in common this question about, are there ways in which human beings can either expand their life or eliminate death entirely? You know, think about Frankenstein. It's about breaching the boundaries of death, bringing a corpse back to life. And what is Dracula but a walking corpse? And he has died and has somehow managed to resurrect himself. And yeah, I think that feeds into what these texts are about, which is about, you know, how does death give life meaning? And are there ways in which we can overcome death and bring the next life to birth here on Earth rather than waiting for whatever's going to happen in religious terms? And they are obsessed with, you know, destroying death.
It's alive! Oh, in the name of God! Now I know what it feels like to be God!
Mark McMenamin was reporting there on two of Gothic literature's most iconic works, Dracula and Frankenstein, and their authors' family ties to Ballyshannon, County Donegal. And after the break, I'll be joined by Cormac Moore to talk about the convening of the Boundary Commission a century ago in 1924. Stay with us.
Follow us on Twitter at RTE History Show.
Welcome back. Article 12 of the Anglo-Irish Treaty provided for a boundary commission to determine the exact delineation of a border between the new Irish Free State and Northern Ireland. After independence, it took almost 2 years for that boundary commission to actually meet. It finally convened about 100 years ago, holding its first meeting on the 6th of November 1924. The journey to this moment was long and convoluted, delayed by political manoeuvring, legal hurdles, and especially Northern Ireland's reluctance to appoint their representative to the Commission. With the stakes high and divergent opinions swirling, the Commission was tasked with a complex mandate to determine the future of territories with mixed communities, weighing the wishes of the inhabitants against economic and geographic considerations. To talk about this, I'm joined now by historian Dr. Cormac Moore, who's currently putting the finishing touches on a book on this very subject. Cormac, you're very welcome back to the History Show to mark the centenary of the beginnings of the Boundary Commission. So you have the Anglo-Irish Treaty signed in December 1921. The Irish Free State is created 12 months later in 1922. Why did it take so long to get round to the Boundary Commission when it was an integral part of the treaty?
Yeah, well, it was only going to be part of the treaty if Northern Ireland opted out of the Free State, which they did do pretty much the first opportunity on 6th of December 1922. So the delay in, first of all, was the Free State weren't going to push it at that time because they were in the middle of a civil war. And it looked pretty bad if you can't control your own territory and you're asking for more territory from the north. And right, that was good justification not to have the Boundary Commission convened in. They also wanted to prepare their case. The Provisional Government set up a new body called the North Eastern Boundary Bureau in the beginning of October 1922, before the Free State was officially recognised. And this was a really impressive body in terms of the people that was involved in it, the work they did, the preparation they did. It kind of culminated in a book called The Handbook of the Ulster Question, which kind of put forward a Free State and Northern Nationalist case for inclusion of big tracts of territory and people from the north to the south. But by July 23, they were ready to look for a boundary commission, and they appointed their commissioner, Owen McNeill. Now, why they appointed Owen McNeill has always been a big question since then, and it hasn't been satisfactorily answered. The person we have to blame, I suppose, is actually W.T. Cosgrave. He insisted that it had to be a member of the Executive Council. Why, I don't know, because there was only 7 members of the Executive Council at the time. They were all incredibly busy. You know, they just had finished a civil war, did so much on their plate. And to actually take someone away, you know, part-time from their job, to take on this mantle of Boundary Commissioner, you know, was a strange choice.
Was it because he was a Northern Nationalist?
So, yeah, so they had to be from Ulster as well, and they also had to be a Catholic. So there was only 2 from Ulster, himself and Ernest Bligh. He was the only Catholic, so that's why he was chosen. Actually, Kevin O'Sheill, who was the director of the Boundary Bureau, he suggested his brother, James McNeill, who's the High Commissioner in London. But Cosgrave wanted someone from the Cabinet, someone he felt close to. So even though McNeill had no background, legal background whatsoever, he was chosen as the Commissioner for the Free State.
The Northern Ireland government was in no hurry to appoint its commissioner, was it?
Our world, the British government. Ireland was not the only place in turmoil, political turmoil at this stage. So was Britain. There were four governments, three elections. There were four colonial secretaries, four prime ministers this time. So 23, when Free State pushed a button to appoint their boundary commissioner, they asked if the Duke of Devonshire, he was the colonial secretary at that time, he had replaced Churchill the previous November. They asked him, can you appoint a chairman and let's convene the boundary commission? And he suggested, why don't we have conference instead? Let's not have a boundary commission if we don't have to. Let's have an agreement between North and South and the British government. And the Irish government, the Free State government, said, yes, actually, that, you know, we're OK with that. Like, our ultimate objective is not based on the boundary commission, which is a flawed solution anyway. We would prefer Irish unity. So we're willing to give that a go. But then there was an Irish election in August 23. That delayed this conference. And then there was the Imperial Conference in London, which had delayed it for a further 2 months. And then there was another election in the UK in November 23. And that delayed it again. The Tories lost power and a new Labour government was formed in January 1924, a minority administration, the first Labour government in history. And the last thing they wanted to have anything to do with was the Boundary Commission, because they wanted to prove they could govern and they did not want the Irish question coming back to bite them. But it did, because the Free State were really pressurising them to move on the Boundary Commission. So a conference did happen in February, the beginning of February 24. And the British government actually offered it was a very poor solution from the Free State's point of view. They offered a kind of a Council of Ireland type solution, even less powers than the Council of Ireland. It was only for matters like fisheries, diseases of animals, railways. It was going to be trialled for a year and there was going to be no boundary commission whilst this kind of meetings of the both parliaments, North and South. But it wasn't based on a majority of the two parliaments, it was based on a majority of each parliament. So basically Northern Ireland could veto every piece of legislation they wanted to. So the Free State government said, no, we're not going for this.
And what were the expectations of the Free State government? Or what was the expectation, certainly, of Irish nationalists about what the Free State would get from the Boundary Commission?
They expected that probably at a minimum they would get most of Tyrone and Fermanagh. They would definitely get Newry and a lot of South Down. They'd definitely get South Armagh. And they felt they would get Derry City as well. That was the minimum. Maximum, they'd get all of Tyrone, all of Fermanagh, huge chunks of South and East Down. They'd get Derry City, they'd get lots of South Armagh.
Which would create a northern state which would not really be viable, would it?
Yeah, I think that's a bit flawed as well, because if you look, they said that economically Northern Ireland cannot survive if they lose, say, Tyrone, Fermanagh and Newry and Derry. But Northern Ireland's economy was based in Belfast and its hinterland. It was not reliant on South and West Ulster. So it could have feasibly survived. Yeah, it would have been a tiny territory.
Well, there are smaller entities in Europe. Exactly, San Marinos of this world, for example, which would survive perfectly. And Monaco, which would survive perfectly adequately.
Yeah, so I always felt that was a flawed argument anyway. But it was based on this wording. So the devil was in the details of the wording of Article 12. And the Boundary Bureau, they put a lot of work into preparing for the Boundary Commission, but they don't know what they're preparing for because there's no definitive interpretation of the article. And they also have this flawed belief by Sinn Féin and a lot of Northern Nationalists that the only thing that Ulster Unionists cared about was their pocket. So ultimately they felt that if they could squeeze them on economics, as Lloyd George said during the treaty negotiations, we're going to make Belfast pay for going out of an All-Ireland Parliament. And also, they had this belief that if Britain left, Ulster would come readily into Ireland. They said they really misinterpreted what the Ulster Unionists wanted. Ulster Unionists hated Dublin more than they loved the Empire. The last thing they wanted anything to do with was Dublin. And that was, no matter what punishment they would have got from England or Ireland, they would never have come into Dublin readily. Just wouldn't have happened. But most nationalists believed they would have. And they based their arguments on trying to convince them of the economic benefits of coming into United Ireland and what would happen if big chunks of territory came through the Free State. And it just wasn't going to wash with Ulster Unionists. But the problem with the preparation for a boundary commission was the wording. You were going to have a boundary based on the wishes of the inhabitants as long as it's compatible with economic and geographic conditions. So which is more important? That was not determined. What areas of unit was going to be decided? Was it going to be counties? Was it going to be poor law units? Was it going to be district electoral divisions? That wasn't determined. And this is all going to be decided by a three-person commission with the chairperson appointed by the British government, who was a stakeholder, even though they pretended that they were a neutral kind of go-between, trying to stop two warring factions tearing each other's heads off. They were a stakeholder, they were a very interested party, and they got to choose who the actual chairman was.
And was there an expectation that, you know, in terms, in the context of the wishes of the people, that there would be regional plebiscites?
That's what the Free State were pushing for. And they were obviously basing it on what was happening elsewhere in Europe. There was about five key boundary commissions they looked at in post-First World War Europe. And there was plebiscites in not all of them, but most of them. And that's what they pushed for. Feetham, Richard Feetham, who did become the chairman in the summer of 24, he did push for plebiscites, but he was warned off by his friend who actually suggested that he be appointed, Lionel Curtis, who worked in the colonial office. He suggested not to have plebiscites. It'd be too messy because you have to bring legislation. The legislation would be extremely messy when you're talking about different areas. You know, there's going to be reams and reams of paper just to determine what areas of unit would be actually the area of the plebiscite. There could be potential violence. Don't go there. That's what Curtis suggests to Feetham. And then when the Boundary Commission is convening, one of the first decisions that Feetham makes is there's going to be no plebiscites.
Let's talk about the three men who formed the Boundary Commission. You've mentioned two of them already. Let's start with the chairman, Richard Feetham. What was his background?
Yes, yeah, so he was born in Wales from a very strong religious background. His father was an Anglican vicar in Wales. One of his brothers actually became the Anglican Archbishop of Queensland in Australia. He himself took the legal route, civil service route. So he went out to South Africa at a young age after graduating from Oxford with Lionel Curtis. The two of them were in Oxford together. And they were part of Lord Milner's kindergarten, as it was called. And this was basically a group of civil servants who were kind of reshaping the boundaries of the South African Union. And they were trying to kind of make the empire, British Empire, relevant in the 20th century to survive and grow with the new conditions it was faced with. And he, you know, rises in the ranks within South Africa. He becomes a member of the Supreme Court in South Africa in 1923 before he's appointed. Now, he wasn't the first choice. The first choice as chairman was Robert Borden, who was a former Prime Minister of Canada. And he turned it down because Ulster refused to nominate their commissioner. So he wanted nothing to do with it. Wise man, not getting involved in a very messy situation. So Feetham is appointed in June 24.
And he's supposed to be an honest broker, but he turns out really, as you suggested, to be anything but neutral.
He's not neutral, but it's not because he's deliberately biased or consciously biased, perhaps. It's because of his worldview and, you know, the people he is close to and what he believes is important. So he's never going to take the Free State side because he is an empire man, and he's not going to be promoting more independence for Ireland and more territory going to a place that might become a republic very soon. So the inherited biases he would have had obviously informed his decisions, and that was very clear when he became the chairman.
Now, the Free State Commissioner was, as you said, Owen McNeill. This was not his finest hour.
No, so we've had obviously two incidents with Owen McNeill are considered not his finest hour. The countermanding order in 1916 and then the Boundary Commission. He really was a terrible choice. He was an honourable man, arguably too honourable for this job. This is messy politics. There was a lot of toing and froing. There was a lot of underhand activity happening, particularly in 1924 within the British system and its media. He wasn't caught out for this, essentially. McNeill, for whatever reason, decided not to inform the Free State government what was happening at all during the...
while. Because they had agreed that there would be no leaks.
Yeah.
But he honoured it, others didn't.
But he should have still kept them somewhat abreast of how things were going to a degree. He also, like, during, if you look at all of the interviews that happened, there was about 575 witness statements were presented to the Boundary Commission, and then subsequently they met a lot of them, the representatives, to interview them, to flesh out what their statements were saying. And he hardly participated at all. He was like, some of the questions he asked were just not relevant. They were totally irrelevant to the Boundary Commission. And his obviously big mistake came in 25 when he accepts the award that Feetham draws up, which is tiny movements of territory to the south, but also movement of territory to the north.
Direction.
He accepted that award because he didn't want the unanimity to be broken, which makes no sense.
In extenuation, was he? I mean, he was still Minister for Education.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Was he spending too much time being Minister for Education, and he did not have as much time to devote to the Boundary Commission as he should have?
Absolutely, yep. And this frustrated Feetham and Bord Dillon, who was the Secretary of the Boundary Commission. They couldn't get to meet McNeill a lot of times because he had to do education estimates for budgets and all of this. And it did actually hold up the Boundary Commission coming up with its award, whereas Feetham and Fisher were full-time as Boundary Commissioners.
Now, let's get around to the elephant in the room. Joseph Fisher, who was the Northern Ireland appointee.
Yeah.
Perhaps it was his finest hour, I don't know. But tell us a little bit about him.
the Northern Ireland government were insistent they were not going to appoint a commissioner. And it showed a sloppiness of the wording of Article 12. The article said that the Northern Ireland government, the Free State government and the British government appoint a chairman. The three governments would appoint their commissioners. It didn't say what would happen if one of them didn't appoint their commissioner. So Northern Ireland said, we're not going to appoint a commissioner and therefore the Boundary Commission can't meet. So the British government, Ramsay MacDonald's British government, decides we can't make this decision ourselves. We need to get legal help. So he invites the Judicial Committee of the Privy Council to rule what happens if Northern Ireland does not appoint his commissioner. And they get judges from all over the empire. And one of them, Knox, he's the Chief Justice of Australia. He takes a month to get to England to convene. There's a further delay, which frustrates the Free State government. And they decide that they rule that basically the Boundary Commission can't meet. So fresh legislation will have to be brought in. So the Free State government and the British government, they agree simultaneous legislation to allow the British government to appoint the actual Northern Ireland commissioner. So this is late summer 24. And Ramsay MacDonald approaches Edward Carson. And Edward Carson is interested. He said he'll do it for Ulster's interests. But the Northern Cabinet have a meeting and they go, you know, he will be good, but this could be very painful for him. Imagine if we have to give up Newry. Newry loyalists will never forgive Edward Carson. There's already a lot of sore loyalists from Donegal, Cavan and Monaghan. And then they decide, look, it's too messy if we get Carson. So they go for Joseph R. Fisher, who had previously written quite a bit to Craig about we should go for Donegal, actually. We should go for North Monaghan. Get rid of Afghanistan areas like Cross Maglen and South Armagh. This boundary commission could be a good thing. You know, this, it's not that we should, you know, not give an inch. We should look to get good territory that suits us and get rid of bad territory and bad people from the north. And even though Ramsay MacDonald was meant to have appointed a commissioner himself, he was lobbying and talking to Craig and getting his advice on who the commissioner would be on their hand. And ultimately, he goes for Joseph R. Fisher, who was the oldest. He was about 70. He had been editor of the Northern Whig newspaper, a very staunch, loyalist newspaper. And he was the last one appointed in late October 24. And that allowed for the commission to meet.
Now, Fisher was as leaky as a sieve. And in 1925, after the Boundary Commission finishes its work, the details of their controversial report were leaked. I presume Fisher was at least partly responsible for that, if not completely responsible for that. This caused uproar, didn't it?
Yes. So, first of all, he told Wilfred Spender, who was the Secretary of the Northern Ireland Cabinet, that you need to feed me information and I'll feed you information. You know, because I want to make sure that we have as strong a case against the Free State as possible. Then when the Boundary Commission convened the first meeting, they said, everything's confidential. You cannot talk to anyone unless it comes through the Secretary of the Boundary Commission that goes out to the press. And they all agreed to that. And Feetham and MacNeill stick to that rigorously. Fisher doesn't. He literally, November, December, he's telling the current, at the time, Northern Whig editor, Robert Lynn, what was happening with the commission. And then he develops this kind of the writing relationship with Florence Reid. She was wife of David Reid, who was an Ulster Unionist MP. And throughout 25, he is literally writing her letters, telling everything that's happening. And there was no doubt about it, but she was filtering that through to the Ulster Unionist ranks. And you can notice the shift in Ulster Unionism. They don't worry from the summer of 25, because they know what's happening. They know that this is going to be, if there is going to be loss of territory, it's going to be very small. They're actually going to gain territory as well. So they're all quite relaxed, whereas the Free State are living in a, you know, willful ignorance of what's going to happen, and they're preparing for huge parts of Northern Ireland to come to the south without knowing what's going to happen, whereas Fisher has been feeding Florence Reid all the information to Ulster Unionists.
So W.T. Cosgrave basically has to indulge in a damage limitation exercise, doesn't he?
So the Morning Post produce a map, basically a recommendation of what the war is going to be. And a lot of newspapers are actually given their own kind of suggestions and what the border was going to be, what was going to be going to the Free State, if anything was going to go to Northern Ireland. But the Morning Post one was, you know, quite accurate. Not fully accurate, but pretty much on the money. So when the Free State find this out and the Northern Nationalists find this out, they go mad. Like, they're absolutely flabbergasted that they're going to gain so little territory and actually give up some really good territory in East Donegal and North Monaghan. So MacNeill resigns from the commission, but he never tells his cabinet colleagues that he actually had agreed to this award, had signed it in mid-October. They finally find this out a few weeks later when Fisher and Feetham come out saying, why did he resign? MacNeill resigned. He agreed with us. They actually were surprised he resigned. So then he has to resign from the cabinet as well. He makes things really difficult for the Free State government, because whatever chance they had of winning the PR battle was over because MacNeill had agreed to sign this award. So literally Cosgrave comes begging, basically, look, we can't have this award. The Republicans have got back in. De Valera will be, you know, in the power very soon. You know, we have to scrap this award. You know, don't publish this report. Keep the border as it is, but give us something in return.
And when was the report published, or when did it emerge into the light of day eventually?
So the National Archives in Kew gave access in 1968.
So it took that long.
The Geoffrey Hand was pretty much the first person who happened to be a distant relative of Owen McNeill. He actually published a book on the report and a very good introduction. And then he did a great essay a few years later on McNeill's role as commissioner. It's still very relevant to this day, even though it's well over 50 years ago. So he published his book in late 69, early 70, and it comes out, the full report.
So all of this was happening 100 years ago. It's a murky and complex story. We're very glad to hear that you've just about finished tying up all the strands of the story for your upcoming book. My guest is Dr. Cormac Moore. Many thanks for joining us on the programme this evening.
Thank you, Miles.
That's all we've time for on this evening's programme. My thanks tonight to Mark McGrath on sound and our researcher Ian Kennelly. The History Show is a Pegasus production for RTE. For now, from me, Miles Dungan, and producer Lorcan Clancy, goodbye and thanks for listening.